Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
You see your target buck, he comes right at last light, he comes to the field, and then, you know, darkness, and that's it. You know, 99% of the time, guys are going to be like, gosh, it was awesome, I saw him. Hopefully he comes out earlier next time. And it's a shifting of the mindset, and instead of thinking that, you think, where can I move to catch him a little bit earlier?
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the RHO podcast. We got a return guest for you this week. Jared Mills is joining the show again. He was on episode 134, where we talked a lot about him and his background in hunting, kind of how he got started with it, how he got started with content at Midwest Whitetail, and how that's led him up to where he's at today. But on this episode, we talked about more strategy stuff, some mobile hunting stuff, even on private land. We talked about his new farm that he's just bought and he's worked on for the first year right now and what that's looking like for him. We talked learning as you hunt, all kinds of good stuff on this episode that I think you guys are going to find interesting. But before we get into it, don't forget about our partners for the episode. One of those is Rodney Hawkins. He is a land specialist with Midwest Farm and Land. If you guys don't know what they do, they specialize in recreational properties. They do some residential stuff as well, but their bread and butter is the recreation stuff. If you're in Illinois, if you're looking to buy ground in Illinois, if you're looking to sell ground in Illinois, they're who you need to talk to, and Rodney can help you out with that. He's also got his own company called RG Outdoors, so if you're in our area, you can check him out in Flora, Illinois. He's on Facebook at RG Outdoors. He's got all kinds of outdoor products, hunting stuff. He's got patio furniture now. He's got e-bikes, and he's adding stuff all the time. So check him out, RG Outdoors, on Facebook. You can also call him at 618-925-3153 for anything related to Midwest Farm and Land or RG Outdoors. Also, Racks Big Game Supplements. Give the deer what they need, how they want it with Racks. This is stuff that the pros use. All these guys that are running outfitters and stuff, they use this. Deer farms use this mineral in these protein blocks. You should too. If you guys are able to do it where you're at, if you want to have the healthiest deer possible end up being the biggest deer possible. I'm not saying it's directly related. You're not going to throw out a bag of mineral and then all of a sudden have 200-inch deer. But it is going to make them healthier. So go check that out at racksmineral.com. You can find out all the information there. You can use the discount code RHOPOD. That's all caps RHOPOD. And you'll get 10% off your entire order there. So let's get into this conversation with one of my favorite guys to talk to in the industry, Jared Mills. I think the last one you were on was 137. I'll put it in the description for people to go back. They can get your backstory on that one. We got into a lot of kind of your upbringing and hunting and how you got into it, which was a cool story. Today, though, since you're a returning guest, we'll talk a little bit more strategy stuff. First of all, we'll start off with, what do you got going on this year as far as content goes or as far as deer hunting or anything like that? Like, what's it looking like for you this fall? We're a little over a week into it, I guess, but...
Yeah, it's hard to believe. First of all, thanks for having me back. I'm pumped to chat again. Yeah, it's hard to believe it's already, we're recording this October 10th, and this season got here sooner than almost any season I can remember. I do think everything seems to be a little bit slow progressing. I mean, I do think sometimes we all get anxious and maybe say that every year, but just in terms of the number of bucks that I'm waiting either to show up for the first time this year, or, you know, maybe there's a couple that had popped in like maybe once in September or August, and I'm just waiting for them to show back up. That list seems longer this year than it typically does. So I've focused my first couple hunts of the year, shooting some does. I think I've killed three does so far. Last night was my very first hunt on the new farm I bought this spring. And so that was awesome. Obviously, it's like, you know, it's hard to describe. You grind all off season, putting in so much time, so much effort into shaping it the way you want. You know, just taking a raw piece of property and trying to make it hunting. And there's only so much you can do in a single off season. But just to be out there sitting for the first time to kind of enjoy the fruits of that labor was awesome. So I'll probably 20 plus deer, a bunch of turkeys. It was a really cool first sit on the new farm. But yeah, for this year, it's a lot of the same. I obviously still filming, documenting everything, wanting, just to show as real as possible, the ups and downs of a typical bow season. Got a number of targets this year, which should be fun. But I think the main storyline for me is the new property and just the unknown that comes along with that. What could show up? What's the hunting going to be like? Trying to learn as much as I can about it, because it's a tough to hunt piece. It'll hold a lot of deer, which is awesome. But it's in contrast to my old piece, it's a lot less huntable. There's a lot more area for the deer to hide and deer to, not get pinched down, making it a challenge. So yeah, my biggest goal is just, as always, to keep it fun, but learn as much as I can on the new farm.
Yeah, that's maybe a good thing and a bad thing. If they've got places to hide, at least if they get some outside pressure, they can go there on you and maybe make it another year, I guess. But yeah, based on last year, you're already behind schedule, right?
Yeah, by a few days for sure. And the weather's been way different than last year too. We just got our first kind of cool front a couple days ago. But by the 7th of October last year, we were already on our second really good cold front of the season. And so it's a pretty contrasting start weather-wise as well.
Yeah, is your new farm in southern Iowa?
I would say more like central,
Okay.
more south than north, but it's kind of close to the middle of the state.
So what have you guys been looking at temps wise like the last week?
Before, like I said, before 2 or 3 days ago, we were still around 80 degrees, upper 70s at least. And the last couple of days have been closer to 70 degrees, upper 60s.
Yeah, that's kind of where we've been at. So talked to Ethan last week and then watching some of
Okay.
Bill's stuff, it seems like up there where they're at, they got a little bit colder than we did, which is normal.
Yeah.
They're farther north, I guess. But we're still,
Yeah.
I mean, considerably south of you, but it's been the same thing. Like this cold front that we got is more like it's been like 70 to 72 for the high. And then I think it got down into the
Yeah.
mid 40s this morning. And we got a few bucks on camera, but nothing huge and not a ton of movement still. I mean, it's still early. And that's something, even those October cold fronts, like when it's this early, it still has to be a pretty good cold front to really get those mature bucks moving, right?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of factors, but yeah, it needs to be more than just at least in my experience, more than a 5 to 10 degree drop. I love to see it a little more than 10, and I think that really forces them to move. Yeah, ours wasn't that much different. I mean, it's nice. It's a lot more comfortable to go sit in 70 than it is 80. 80 to 85. But I'd love to, get down in the 60s for sure to really get some of these bucks moving. And I should say, the movement actually has been pretty good for as warm as the temps have been. It's been, last few minutes in the evenings, but the morning movement, especially the last few days, has been really solid. Like you said, it's been cool in the mornings. We got a little bit of rain overnight, and so, this time of year, I think, hopefully the scrapes will light up this afternoon, this evening, as the bucks go to freshen those. Rain's kind of been at a premium for us lately, so that should, help some of the activity too.
Yeah. Did you have pretty decent timely rains at least during your growing season? Because for us,
Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday, good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
It's like in August and September, it was super dry. My plots looked pretty
Same.
bad.
Yeah, I mean, up until that point, entire summer was awesome. Like you couldn't get any better. We were getting rain pretty much every week, not too much rain though. But then, fall food plot season, it changed quickly. It looked like it was going to continue, and then we just hit a dry pattern. And I had to, really baby a lot of the food plots to try to help them limp through, by, some foliar fertilizers and things like that, just to try to help them because we weren't getting any rain. And in fact, I just sent a screenshot a few minutes ago to a buddy of mine. I say we got rain. My farm, I was looking at the rain map, and there's a perfect circle around my farm that didn't get any rain
Of
last night.
course.
Everywhere around it got,
Yeah.
half inch, 3/4 of an inch, and somehow it split right around my farm last night, which is typical, but
Yeah.
that's how it goes.
Yep. I understand that. That's the same way this last rain that we had. Like here in town at my house, we probably got close to an inch. And then over where I actually have food plots, like I went out there the other day and I had a camera that was acting up and I pulled it and like there was dust on the ground. So it's crazy. And that's like 15 miles from the house. So it's not like it's that far, but it's not been real great in the fall. And actually something I'd done is I've gone to more like clover stuff because the last 3 or 4 years has been really dry for us in the fall. So I'd gone to more clover. That way, at least if it was wet in the spring, I would have something. But this year, with as dry as it got, like, and with not having anything else, the deer just hammered the clover what was there. So they really mowed it down. And then when we hit that drought in August, like a lot of it almost died. And it's pretty spotty now too. That clover even is. We got dry enough, and with the browse pressure, now they're still in it some. And that the rain before this last one we got actually did hit over there, so it brought it back a little bit. But it's just food right now for me is not looking great. So I was curious because again, Ethan said that they had some decent rains. He's got some good looking plots up there. Like it must be nice.
They got a lot more rain than we did. I'm like 2.5 hours from Ethan, and they were catching a lot of those timely rains, after fall planting, in that August time frame, than we were. But and there's a lot of factors too. Like clover, typically, like you said, it's gonna hold up better just because it gets established earlier in the year. But I mean, ultimately, everything's gonna need rain,
Yeah.
and especially if it's a spot that just gets baked with sun during the day. A shaded clover plot is a whole different story. Most likely it's not going to struggle as bad. And then, there's different varieties and combinations of clover and chicory especially that can withhold some of that heat and drought conditions a little bit better, different varieties. So there's so many factors there, but the bottom line is everything's going to need a little bit of rain, and sometimes you catch it, sometimes you don't.
Yep, at some point or other, it's got to have some water on it. So people might remember the river bottom farm that you used to own at least part of, right? Is this the first farm that you've owned since then? Have you been leasing or have you had something in between? Because it's been a few
No.
years ago, right?
So when I sold my half of that farm, I immediately took that money and bought a new farm. It was
Okay.
just over 100 acres in eastern Iowa, and I had that farm for about 3 years. And just sold that early at the beginning of this year to
Okay.
buy the farm I currently have. So, I own that one and developed that one for 3 years. And that farm was awesome. Like when I, it's always interesting because it's every property is a little bit different. Every property has its advantages, maybe challenges. And so, one really cool thing about that farm, it was very raw cattle pasture. Really no hunting history, which is what I prefer. Like I want something that's full potential, but a blank slate. And that one, I got to the point where it was a really good hunting farm, and it was a good point for someone to take over. And I wasn't necessarily planning on selling it, but this other one came up for sale that I really wanted to pull the trigger on. And in order for me to swing it financially, I had to offload that farm to roll into this current one. But that farm was awesome. Like I said, about 100 acres. And it was so huntable. Like it didn't have the amount of cover to hold a ton of deer, but if there was a shooter there, you were going to kill him. No question about it. There's just enough pinches and funnels and stuff like that. So it wasn't a property you're going to hold 4 or 5 mature bucks, but those one or two that you do hold, you'll kill them if you want to, if you spend enough time there. Whereas this one does have the potential to hold 4 or 5 mature bucks. A little bit bigger, a lot more cover, a lot more bedding opportunity, holding capacity, but super thick. There's spots where I'll hunt, and I could be within 30 yards of a buck and never see him. It's that type of low, thick cover, great for holding deer, but challenging to hunt. There's not a lot of pinches and funnels that force movement. So like anytime you have that, it's hard to predict. It's hard to like get those setups where a deer is going to walk by in bow range because they're just it they just doesn't have those features of it. And I'm working on things you can do to kind of help that a little bit, but there's going to be some luck involved for sure as far as killing them. The biggest thing I can do is just to try to create those cells, but ultimately hold as many deer as possible, give them everything they need, and eventually you're going to catch up with one just by the deer always spending time there.
Oh yeah, and I'd say too, like this being your first year there, you're going to find out a lot just hunting it. Like there may be something there that's pinching or funneling those deer down that you didn't even really think would, just like for some reason you've seen it before. Like why do all these deer go to that spot? Like there's not a ton of rhyme or reason, or maybe there's something super subtle and it just takes being out there and hunting them to actually see it. Because I mean, you can't set enough cameras to know everything about a property. I mean, you just got to be out
No.
there and hunt it to figure it out.
Yeah, and then cameras just give you such a small glimpse. Like you know where he walked in this little 10-yard span, but ultimately when it's not a pinch or a funnel, you don't know exactly where he came from or exactly where he went. And so yeah, to your point, it's going to be a ton of learning, but that's the fun part as well. In my first sit last night, I decided to hunt the spot that I could see the most. Just you could call it an observation sit if you want, but I was still somewhat in the game. But I could see for a couple hundred yards in multiple directions. I was just like, hey, let's just figure out where the deer coming from. Where are they ultimately going at the end of the night? And so I saw a ton of deer, but they all came from different directions. They all left different directions. So I wouldn't say I learned a ton on last night's sit, but it's all good. It was super, super enjoyable either way.
Yeah, at least you figured out that there's no set place right there that seems like they're coming in and out, right?
Yeah, I know it was the central food source that I had. I just wanted to kind of have an enjoyable sit watching a lot of deer. Just get the first one on the new farm, just that type of sit. I didn't initially want to go sit a pinch that, maybe I'd see one or two deer for the night. So it was a fun sit and saw a few bucks, nothing great, but I think I saw 4 bucks and probably 16, 17 does, something like that. So it was awesome.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's RUBRIK.com.
It was a really cool set. Saw a bunch of turkeys to start off the night, which I didn't even know I had that many turkeys, but there was probably a dozen of them that came out. So just, from a landowner perspective, that was awesome. Like it's hard to describe like that feeling. It's really cool. Just the rewarding of all the effort that you put into it.
It's definitely a long-term gratification type of deal. There's no short term when it comes to, I mean, you can put food on a property and then attract some deer, and that's, I guess, somewhat short term if you're talking a couple months, like if you started in August. But most of it's like down the road. I'm putting in all this work throughout, like you said, throughout the summer, throughout the year, to finally see what it's going to do this fall. And then not only that, but like 3 or 4 years down the road, right? Because that's when you really start to see the fruits of your labor. But that's really cool, in my opinion, working on properties or your own property. Like, we do it mostly for deer. Guys like us are doing it pretty much for whitetails. But to see the benefit it has for all the other wildlife is really cool.
Yeah, it is. And it's just, I mean, again, we're doing it because we love hunting, like you said, but it's just cool from a wildlife perspective. It's cool knowing that, hopefully you put in enough food that you're going to have healthy deer going into next year, to that long-term point that you were referring to, helping them make it a less stressful winter than they had before you started putting in that work and that effort and passing deer, trying to get them to maturity and things like that. It is definitely a long-term play, but there's so many more benefits to it, and And again, like if you step back, it's like, man, that's a lot of work just to kill a deer, which is like a lot of outsider's perspective. But when you start to learn to appreciate the process of it and actually enjoy the work of it, like it's, again, it's so hard to communicate how rewarding that is. Like I think I even did an interview in the tree last night kind of talking about it. I realize that there's a lot of people that don't own land and won't ever own land. And, you know, it's just the reality of it. But I do hope that it still continues to be a dream for, it's always been, my dream. Like I didn't think I'd ever own land in my life, but you work towards it and make it happen. And I hope a lot of people still keep that dream and keep that as a goal, because I'm not sure that there's anything better, at least in the hunting realm. The land ownership and being able to work the land is about as good as it gets.
Mm-hmm. It's one of those deals where you almost get as excited about like getting a picture of a big mature buck on your property that you work so hard on as you do actually getting out there and killing them, just because it's like, that's the reward of it. You've put all this work in and now he's there using it. And like, just getting a picture of him. And people wouldn't understand that either. I mean, like, it's a picture of a deer. Why are you so excited about it? But like, it's all this work that I put in is working. I can see it.
Yeah, for sure. Like I said, it's hard to communicate to someone that hasn't, done that or been in that experience. But yeah, it's awesome. It's as good as it gets.
I did a episode talking about, apparently, like out in Catalina Island, there's these mule deer that are like invasive. And they're trying to get rid of them. And their first proposal was to bring in like helicopters and shoot them like they do pigs in Texas, which I thought was awesome. But of course they didn't like that because we're talking California. So there's this one lady who like, she represents the island for the Los Angeles Fire Department or something to that effect. She was talking about, because now they're wanting to bring in professional hunters and shoot these deer like on the ground. And she's talking about how she's glad they didn't do the helicopter thing, but this is still so inhumane. And she quote unquote said they were going to slaughter the deer or something like that. And it's like those kind of people, you could never communicate what we're talking about to those kind of people, because in their mind, like this is the most horrific thing that could ever happen to a deer. Well, we know the best possible outcome for that 5-6-year-old buck is probably an arrow through both lungs. Otherwise, it's going to be brutal. I mean, it's just the nature of nature.
It is. And like when you do put that much effort, again, we know it is, it's for the benefit of the hunting too, but we do so much more for those deer than that, lady by example. Mm-hmm. She thinks she's doing more by not killing them, but ultimately we're providing them way more. We're putting way more money towards conservation and habitat and all that than they ever will. Mm-hmm. And so, there's always, those people are always going to exist. It's just, just a difference in mindset and basically in ignorance and not understanding the other side of the situation.
Yep. It's kind of off on a tangent there, but like, I don't think those people understand how bad it would be without hunters, because like hunters are the real conservationists and the ones out there taking care of it, the ones that care about it, because it's worth something to them. Like, I don't know, without us, without hunters in general, it'd be so much worse than those people could imagine. But anyway, not to get too much off on that. Back to your property. I was telling you before we got on, I think it was your last video you put up. You talked about not kind of pigeonholing yourself into one spot, like hanging permanent stands. Not that there's anything wrong with hanging permanent stands, but a lot of times when you do it, and I've fell victim to this, it becomes so easy that you go hunt them way too much and you're either burning out that spot or you're never really in the game, because that's where you hang that stand and then you leave it and you see deer 200 yards away all the time, but you never move and get in the game, right? So you're talking about being mobile even on your private land, whether that's permission property or land you own. And the guy that co-hosts our Friday episodes does a ton of public land hunting. I do a ton of private land hunting. So this is something that we talk about a lot, like taking that public land kind of mindset to your private property in some ways when it comes to strategy especially can be really, really good. And I know you can speak to that as much as anybody.
Yeah, for sure. And I've never thought about it as like, the public land style hunting versus private land style. I just think about it as like what works for me and strategy wise. That comparison kind of came to light recently. Earlier this summer, I spoke at the Mobile Hunter Expo out in Ohio, and while I was on the phone with Christopher that runs it, I said, "Hey, is there anything you want me to touch on? Like, you invited me to speak. Is there anything that you think would resonate well with your audience?" And he's like, "Man, I've watched you for a long time, and I think the biggest thing about you is you hunt private land like a public land hunter." And so when he said that, I was like, I've never thought about it that way, but I guess I could see that from, a public land hunter's perspective. And so again, I've never thought about it as like a style. I don't like the public versus private comparison. I think it's extremely misunderstood on both sides. So I don't like the comparisons, and so I never thought about it from a style. But the number one reason that I do it is it works. Like I've seen it so much over the years of just those first time sits, sits that you have never spooked a deer from, a tree you've never spooked a deer from, you've never left residual scent that the deer has encountered and maybe adjusted his route. It just I think we've all probably experienced how good those first time sits can be, but not everyone like takes it to the next level to try to get as many first time sits as possible. It's like, well, first time sit was good, but now everything else is going to be a second and a third and a fourth. Like that's just the nature of hanging a permanent stand, right? But the other aspect too is you have to be comfortable with mobile hunting in general, whether you're in a saddle or a tree stand. You got to have a system that works for you and you are really efficient with it. Otherwise, it's going to be way too frustrating a process to even try to do. So those two big things: one, it works, and two, I'm really comfortable with my hang and hunt setup. It's not frustrating for me to hang sticks and stand and do it. So yeah, I try to be as mobile as possible. And the other thing too, let's say you own a farm, it's like the good spots. Why don't you just hang the permanent stand in those good spots? The thing is, when you're targeting individual bucks, not very seldomly do I have a buck that I'm targeting that did the same thing as the previous one I was targeting from a different year. They're all different. They're all individual. They'll use little, different parts of the farm as maybe their core area. Even farms that aren't great, most of the farms I hunt aren't that big, but they'll still core up in a different area. They'll travel a different way. So, I try to just make a game plan on the deer I'm hunting. And if I was to, hang permanent sets for that deer, those permanent sets probably aren't going to do me much good the next year when I'm targeting a different buck. It's just I just haven't seen them repeat the exact same types of patterns. And of course, every property is going to have spots that are just good over and over again, right? A pinch or a funnel or food source or whatever. And permanent sets there are fine. It's just kind of you got to have it. But it's all these other spots where you're trying to get close and have some better encounters or daylight encounters. And that's where I think the mobile hunting and first time sits and element of surprise really comes into play. And so, I think I talked about it on one of my recent episodes, but there's things I can do to try to make that process a little less frustrating. And one of those is scouting in the off season or prior to the season and finding good trees to hang and hunt in. You may not ever hunt there, but knowing a section of the farm, knowing that hey, there's a really good oak tree that doesn't have a ton of clearing needed or anything like that. It's going to be easy stand to set up in the dark. Mark that one on the map. And I'll have a bunch of these pins that all labeled potential stand tree, on my app, and that helps a ton. Like that's half the battle compared to going completely in blind and trying to find a tree, especially in the dark in the morning. I've done it before where you get up and you have no shooting lanes because you didn't really know what it looked like. So trying to be ahead of the game a little bit on that helps. But yeah, in general, to summarize it up, it just works. the more first time sits I have, the higher my odds are, period. Like I've seen it way too often to, try to deviate from that. So I try to create as many first time sits as possible. It doesn't have to be much. Like sometimes it's a 30-yard move, 40-yard move. Like it doesn't have to be a dramatic move, but just a little bit gets you in the game, especially when we're talking about bow hunting.
Yeah, that's something that, like, I even, like, when we go help people on their property or whatever, that's something I've gotten away from when we first started, was like pinning where to put a stand and, like, hey, this looks like a good spot, put a stand here, because guys will put a stand up and they'll never move that 30 or 40 yards. So we got to the point now where it's like, hey, this is a good area. Number one, we're going to change stuff. So the deer are going to change a little bit. They may not use it the same, but like, this is a good area for a stand. Don't go hang one necessarily yet. Keep your options open. And then if you want to hang a permanent stand after you figure them out a little bit, you can do that. But I think, like, I take kind of a hybrid approach to it, I guess, because like you said, I've got some farms that I've been hunting for so long that I know those spots that are just like those pinches or like an open gate on a fence rail kind of deal. Like, they're just pretty good spots year over year. But then I have a mobile set up for just what you're talking about. If you see them consistently, or you're getting pictures of them in one spot, or like you did your scouting and you found a good tree, now you can still go do that. And I think that is the problem, is guys get so used to doing what they know, and it's easy, right? Like, let's face it, most of us whitetail hunters are pretty lazy sometimes, and it's just so much easier to go climb in a stand than it is to take all that stuff in, which is what you're talking about, get comfortable with that mobile setup. And I'll be honest, like, I'm not the greatest at it. I don't do it enough to be like super smooth. So I have to go in pretty early, and especially self filming, which you doing the self filming that you do and all the mobile hunting is just amazing to me, because I hate self filming and I hate mobile hunting, but I do them
Doing
both. And but I think it's just like you said, you got to get used to it. Find a system that works for you, and then you will have a lot more success. Like, there's no doubt about it that guys that have that in their bag have kill more bigger deer, or they kill more of their target bucks, because why wouldn't you put that tool in the toolbox, right? Like, it's stay as well rounded as a hunter as you can. Don't put yourself in a box and stay open to that kind of stuff.
It's a mindset, it more than anything. And just thinking about or knowing that you have the option to move is number one. Like, to give you an example, I think a lot of people face, and including us, we fall into this boat too. Everyone probably does. But, let's say you set up wherever on a field edge and you see your target buck. He comes right at last light. He comes to the field, and then, darkness, and that's it. 99% of the time, guys are gonna be like, gosh, it was awesome. I saw him. Hopefully, he comes out earlier next time. And it's a shifting of the mindset. And instead of thinking that, you think, where can I move to catch him a little bit earlier? That, it just knowing that you have that option to do that is probably the biggest hurdle. A lot, again, a lot of guys just are like, just you almost rely too much on luck. Like, I hope he does this next time. That there's just a lot of, and I'll be the first to admit, there's a ton of luck involved in everything we do. For something to play out along the way, there has to be luck. But if you can eliminate some of that, or just not be afraid to try to move a little bit closer, I think that's that mindset shift that, I'm talking about.
That we fall into that trap with the cameras too, right? Like, you're getting this buck on camera and he's like 30 minutes after dark, and you're like, man, I gotta wait like 2 more weeks and that'll get closer and closer and closer to daylight. Well, like, your camera's right on the edge of food and you can hunt the bed, like, you can hunt between there and the bedding that he's coming from. Maybe you just move up 100 yards and catch him before daylight, and then you don't have to wait for 2 weeks and hope your neighbor doesn't kill him in the meantime. Like, just having that option. And definitely, like, you made a good point too, which I don't think I've heard it put that way, but you talk about first time sits a lot. So much so, I think Drury had a video called like First Time In way back in the day where they talked about that. So it's not like a new concept, but we still think about it as, okay, I've got one first time like all season. And if I've got five stands, I've got five first hunts. Well, it doesn't have to be that way if you maximize the amount of first times that you have. That's an interesting concept that Like, I hadn't heard it put that way before, but it makes a ton of sense.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
Yeah, for sure. And it, like I said, it just works. And just got to be comfortable with it. You know, practice your hanging hunt setup, you know, in the backyard or wherever it is. Find little ways or gear that makes it more simple, more quiet. And another thing we should probably point out too is the safety. Like, the more you're doing that style of hunting, the more you are, you know, more at risk. So like, safety becomes more important in that situation than going to a preset stand. So, mm-hmm. you know, making sure, you know, guys, if you're new to that or they're, you know, they're going to try to get into it, you know, still safety first. Like, that's a bigger consideration probably than most situations. So just be always being aware of that and being attached to the tree.
Mm-hmm. That's a big thing. I saw a guy on Facebook that I know, he'd posted it. He runs a group or something, but buddy of mine, he was getting into his permanent set. Actually, I think he said he was changing a strap on it, and whether he was on the sticks or he was in the stand, something gave way on him and he fell out of the tree while he was changing a strap and like ended his season basically. Fortunately, like, it didn't kill him, because that happens, but it's it's tough to hear, and that stuff happens every year. But like I said, you just got to be tied to the tree, like the whole process, especially if you're doing mobile stuff. And like you said, it's even higher risk maybe than your permanent setups. But most of the time, a lot of times you're doing that in the dark too. So it adds another element to it. You just got to make sure you're being safe about it. And another thing that makes this mobile hunting easier and safer is just being in decent shape, right? Like, it's hard to pack all that stuff in, to put it on the tree and to get in safely if you're not in decent shape. You know, if you're just out of shape and trying to do it that way, you're going to have a lot harder time and you're going to be less likely to do it too, which is going to hurt your success.
Yeah, it definitely helps. But we all can get in some pretty awkward situations depending on the tree. And so, yeah, staying attached. I say higher risk just in the fact that it's not a simple, you know, tie into a safe line and climb up a ladder.
There's more moving parts.
There's moving parts. You're doing something as you're climbing. You need to make sure you're using the lineman's belt and all that. But to your point on the guy that fell, like, there's probably lower risk in that your straps aren't sitting up there all season long, you know, having the chance to be chewed on by squirrels or rot or whatever it is. You know, there's lower risk on the hang and hunt style of hunting in that regard. So safety has always got to be number one. It's not worth it. Nope. It's, you've heard way too many horror stories, you know, like you, I'm sure I've met guys that have had some terrible falls and it's just not worth it.
Nope.
We all got to come home safe at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's right. So you got your Elevate hat on. So there is, like, what's your mobile setup? You're using an Elevate stand, I guess. Do they have sticks and stuff too? Is like your whole system? What does your mobile system look like?
They do. Yeah. I prefer their smallest stand, which is their Ultra. It's super light. They actually even shaved a little. They just came out with newer versions, earlier this year, and shaved even more weight. And it's a small platform. You know, I think that's maybe the only knock against it. If you're used to hunting out of big stands, you know, it may take a while to get used to it, but to me, you know, I don't move around a lot in the stand. Like, you know, I'm pretty stationary. I stand most of the hunt. I'm usually filming or doing whatever. And so a small platform doesn't bother me. It's the lightweight and everything that matters the most to me. So, the lighter the weight, again, the more comfortable that hang and hunt process is going to be. And so, yeah, I like the Ultra X from Elevate as my favorite hang and hunt stand, paired with their Send sticks. So, again, I've done hanging hunts with a lot of different stands over the years, and they, you know, keep getting better and better. And this setup is the best setup I've used. But again, it's just being comfortable with whatever you have. The right gear makes a huge difference. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not going to like doing it with a heavy steel stand for sure. But you know, whatever you choose, whatever lightweight setup you have, just be comfortable with it. Practice with it. The more you do it, the more it becomes second nature. Mm-hmm. And another big part of that too is being able to comfortably carry it in, whether it's, you know, integrating it into your pack somehow. And I'm still kind of playing with that a little bit, you know, whether I wear the stand on my back with the, you know, the backpack straps on the platform and then attach my pack to that. I've actually got a new pack this year that I'm going to try. It's almost like an out west hunting frame pack, mm-hmm. where basically I'll put the platform of the, or the, I'll put the tree stand against the frame, and then the pack will come around that. And so it should bundle pretty tight. And sometimes it depends how far I'm going in. If I'm going in, not as far, you know, a couple hundred yards or something, I don't mind just carrying the stand in my hand or carrying the stick, one of the two, and bow in the other hand, and just roll. But if I'm going in, you know, a lot deeper, it's a lot rougher walk in, which tends to be quite often. I want something really efficient and where everything packs together nicely on my back.
Yeah. Do you ever think about how much easier it would be if you didn't film?
All the time, but I also know I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
It's like, I've shot a few does, even just like watching that footage back, like the two does I shot the other day. The first doe I shot, I thought I made a great shot on her. You know, the shot felt good, looked good. And she sprinted off 15, 20 yards and stopped and slowly walked in the timber like nothing was wrong. And you look mm-hmm. at the footage, like, and I don't know how that deer just didn't fall down. So like little stuff like that. So you start to analyze, was I just a little bit low? Did she, you know, kind of turn and make that arrow angle more steeper? And I only got one long, like it's just the analysis alone is worth filming, and just learning from, you know, deer behavior wise, but also just the documentation. I love being able to review all my hunts, go back and relive those experiences. And to me, all those benefits far outweigh the hassle of carrying that gear in.
Yeah. I actually, sometimes too, I will go back and look at video and I'll notice stuff that I didn't notice while I was hunting. Cause I'm either focused on getting that camera where it needs to be or looking around to make sure nothing else is coming or like whatever. And then that camera will pick up stuff that I didn't see. There was a buck last year that, and it probably would have changed honestly how I went about the situation, but a little buck had come out into this open grass field and a doe came out with him. And I knew this bigger buck had been in there, the buck I was after. And I thought, man, he's got to be somewhere close with this doe, but didn't see him. Eventually that doe started working a little bit my direction. Well, then the big buck came out behind her, ran over and ran off the little buck and then went back to that doe. When I went back and looked on the video, I could see him in the frame back in the brush behind her, and I never saw him in person. Like, he was back there the whole time and the camera caught him, but I never did see him. I'm sure you've had some of those experiences.
For sure. Yeah. I've almost the exact same thing. I've also had it too, where I've called two bucks and thought they just didn't hear me, but then you go back and review the footage and you can see their ears turn. They just weren't interested at the time, or maybe they were, you know, marking that waypoint to come back to later or whatever. But same thing, you know, if knowing that, I would have, you know, changed. I wouldn't have grunted a second time or louder or, you know, whatever it was, if I knew he heard me the first time. Stuff like that. It's pretty cool what the camera can pick up that you can learn from. I think a lot of guys don't think about that benefit of filming. They think about, oh, cool, I got it on camera, I can share it with people. But from a learning standpoint, it's pretty powerful too.
Yeah, and recovery, like you said on that though, being able to actually see where you hit, because man, it's a huge percentage of the time that when you go back and look at it on the video, it's not exactly where you thought you hit that thing. And that can change recovery time from 30 minutes to 3 hours, right? So
For sure.
like you said, you go from one lung to double lung, that makes a big difference. Those things can go a long way on one lung. Whereas if you double lung them, obviously most of the time, 30 minutes, you're in good shape. But that to me is worth having something. It doesn't have to be professional quality. You don't have to be Jared Mills out there with the amazing footage.
No.
As long as you've got something on that deer where it's stable, because a lot of times, like, I think the bow mounted stuff is great, but for actually seeing where you hit the deer, it shakes so much and it moving, and you're not holding the bow up after you shoot anyway most of the time. If you've got something stable, like whether it's a GoPro even up over your shoulder or something on a small camera arm, it's going to make a huge difference, I think, in your recovery. And then again, learning from, okay, you can go back and look, I hit this deer here the last time and she did this. I hit this buck here. Looks like at the same spot, so he might do the same thing.
It's like you said, you don't have to make it difficult. It could be your cell phone, it could be a GoPro, it could be whatever, it could be super wide, but as long as you can see that arrow going through, light and knock obviously helps. You see that arrow going through, you see the deer's immediate reaction too. That's another thing to study. See exactly where, maybe went into the cover. Mark, you can see the exact tree, because all that type of stuff is so hard to recall in our mind. It's almost like you black out for that period of time. It's like, gosh, I have no idea where I've watched him go in, but it could be anywhere in this 25 yards that he went in the timber. Or I swear I saw it right behind his shoulder. I can't tell you how many tracking jobs I've been on with buddies that tell you where they hit it, and when you get up to the deer, it's not there. It's almost like your mind plays tricks on you when you're in the heat of the moment, and you just there's too much going on for you to remember those little tiny details sometimes. And that's where the footage can make It can truly make or break it. If you bump a deer that you shouldn't have been tracking that quick, that might have been the difference
Yeah,
right
forget
there.
about it.
So, like, yeah, there's a lot of advantages when it comes to shot replay and tracking decisions for sure.
And then there is the aspect too of being able to share that with people. Because I remember last time we talked, you talked about, before you started filming, come home and tell your dad about the hunt you had. And then when you started filming, it's like you could actually show them and kind of they could relive that with you. That's a super cool part as well. And now, like you being able to share it with tens of thousands of people every time you go out and do something, that's got to be awesome.
Yeah, it is. It's fun. Like that's certainly a benefit of it. Again, as for me, priority is still the other stuff. That just the personal documentation of it is still my favorite. But yeah, and my hope is, like, why I try to keep the hunts as real as possible and the quality as high as possible. Like I said, I wouldn't want guys to try to reach that quality level unless they really wanted to, but you don't have to film your hunts. But the reason I do, I think it helps people learn more. The higher the quality, the more you can take from it, the more it feels like you're in the tree and you can learn from that experience. I learn from every single one of my hunts, and so I hope to, if I can replicate what I experience actually in the tree through video, then I feel like others can also learn that way too, compared to if it was a lower quality video or, a lot of distractions, out of focus, poor audio, all that type of stuff just removes the viewer from feeling like they're in the tree with you.
Yeah, that's one reason I think a lot of people do enjoy your content. That's one of the reasons I enjoy it, is because of that learning aspect. And you're a knowledge transfer guy. Did that come from like working with Bill? Because obviously he's big on that too. Like it seems like he is huge on teaching and that aspect of it. So much so that I guess you guys had a TV show kind of around that at one time, maybe. Did that come from working with him, or did you have that before, like from maybe even from your sports background of like coaching and all that kind of stuff?
It's a good question. I think it's probably a combination of both. There's no doubt Bill is the one, like, my first experience in the industry. So naturally that's going to, you know, kind of shape my mindset as I get into it and learn what this whole content world and hunting film industry is about. And he, you know, is as good as anybody at the teaching style. Mm-hmm. The other thing, you know, I think the sports background helps. I think also too, just the interaction with viewers. You start putting hunts out there and you get questions like, hey, why did you do this? Or how did you do this? And so when you start getting those questions over and over again in all different styles and formats, you know, it kind of tells you like, hey, there's a need for this information. Like, people want to learn. And then, you know, I obviously love when people reach out saying, you know, thank you for helping me, you know, become a better hunter. You know, your advice helped me kill this buck, or, you know, whatever it is, you know, that's cool. And so like, the more that happens, the more it just teaches me that, you know, I need to be aware of the education side and the power of that and to better explain things. I think that's one of the biggest things that I still don't struggle with it, but I it's still a big part of what I try to get better at is explaining the process, because it's hard. You almost have to step outside your mind, because some of the stuff that I do is just second nature. Like, I don't think about needing to explain why I did something. But you almost have to remove yourself from that mindset, putting yourself someone that doesn't know your story, doesn't know your process, and spell it out. You know, mm-hmm. You know, who cares if it's reiterated information for somebody? You may have a first time viewer that you could really help, and that alone is worth just explaining it in more detail.
Yeah.
You know, as you do it. So
there's also that thing where like you have to hear something like 7 or 12 times before you remember it anyway. So like, yeah. I feel like there can never be too much good information out there, but it's cool to see, like I mentioned Drury earlier. So they're like in the outdoor space, there's such a huge lineage from Midwest Whitetail and from Drury. Like, a lot of people came from one or two of those, or either one of those, right?
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
And I feel like they both, while different, have similar aspects in the teaching part, the knowledge transfer part. And whether, like Midwest, you look at the hunting public guys, like obviously they have a different style than you do, but they still have a big teaching aspect to what they do too. And I think that's
right. That's
really cool to see that has all come from kind of similar places. And I think it's great that all that stuff is out there, because it does help a lot of new hunters, a lot of, you know, guys have been doing it for a while too.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's cool to see like just the viewers, like the appreciation of it. And I think a little bit of a shift industry wide to that style of content, you know, like the more relatable stuff, mm-hmm. because for you to really learn something, it has to be somewhat close to your hunting style. Right. And I think when I think back to like the old days of TV hunting, and there's still a lot of it today, but you know, I think of like guys traveling from outfitter to, you know, like that type of, where it's just trying to get these, rack up these kills for entertainment value. And like I said, there's still a lot of that and there's nothing wrong with it, but I think overall, the consumer has shifted towards enjoying the more relatable stuff the most because of that learning aspect. You know, if you can't learn from it, then you are just watching it almost purely for entertainment.
Yeah. And there's like, I feel like all that stuff shapes the rest of how people hunt too. Cause if you go back and look at like the mid 2000s TV days, they're killing 3.5-year-old deer so they could get something on TV. And they're saying that's a mature buck. And like at that time, people were like, 3.5 is mature. Well, then it got to 4.5. And now it's like 5.5, 6.5, depending on where you're at, right? and it shapes the way everybody else does everything. And there's a little bit of the other side of that too, where like you're saying, people are getting to where they want more of the other style, more relatable stuff. And that's kind of driven it a little bit to where we're seeing more of that content, kind of the stuff like what you're doing. And yeah, it's like most people can't go from outfitter to outfitter and just spend tens of thousands of dollars a year to hunt all these animals. I do think like you think of Realtree road trips. I think one way they did that but were able to relate though was like they showed the back end part of it, right? Like the campfire kind of deal.
Right.
It was kind of cool to see there's different ways you can relate to the audience while still kind of trying to provide some entertainment. Because I'm sure you're balancing that too. If you're not entertaining, people aren't watching it. And then you're not teaching them anything.
Right. For sure. Yeah. Yeah. I think the biggest thing for me too, as a creator, you know, someone that creates this content, like I think knowing who you are and knowing what you're capable of is the biggest thing. To give you an example, I don't watch any other hunting content. I don't watch anybody on YouTube. I don't watch any videos. And that's not like, it's not because I don't want to or like that I don't think there's good stuff out there. I know there is. Mm-hmm. But it's because I don't want any external influence on how I produce my videos and the type of content that I put out there. I can't be anyone else.
Right.
Like I can only put out my style of hunting and my personality and that's it. Like if I live in that world and I don't have any other external influence, you know, even subconsciously, I think you start watching a bunch of other people, you subconsciously think like, oh, that's how I need to do it. Or like, you know, it just creeps into like your mindset as you're editing. For me, I don't want any of that. I want to just stay within my limits and who I am and keep it relatable for guys and just put out there the stuff I know that I can produce and not try to produce something different that's maybe more out there, more entertaining, whatever it is. That's I think the biggest thing for me, and that may not help everyone. Maybe some people need that outside influence, you know, creatively or whatever, but for me, a big part of what I do is just making sure I don't watch anything else. I just, one, it's hard to find the time, but it's like, I just don't want it. It's even subconsciously, I don't want to be influenced by other content, you know, and again, that's not a knack at other stuff by any means. Like, I know there's probably stuff out there that I should be watching and could help me, but, you know, again, at the end of the day, like I said, you can't be something you're not. And so, you know, if I just live in my own world from a content perspective, I think I can, you know, maximize my abilities.
Oh yeah, for sure. I passively watch a lot of stuff, like while I'm working on deer heads and at work and things like that, or I'll listen to a lot of podcasts and I'll struggle with that a little bit. Like I'll see something, I think, man, that looks cool. Maybe I should try to do that. Or like I'll hear somebody like phrase things a certain way or certain things they'll say. And then I'll catch myself like almost repeating what they were doing. I'm like, you got to stop because that's not you. And like you said, you can only be you. And whether you're making you and Joe Blow could be making the exact same type of videos, but you guys are also, as long as you're being yourself and he's being himself, it's going to be different content because we're all individual people. And as long as you're not trying to be like him, he's not trying to be like you, it's going to have some separation. People are going to relate. Some people are going to relate more with one guy versus the other. And I think as long as you're staying, you know, true to what you do and what you are and what you can be, then there is going to be more people that relate with that and stick with that too. Like, I think that's the way to build an audience that's going to stick with you and is going to be interactive and is going to watch your stuff. And then, and in turn, you can kind of influence and hopefully help along the way.
For sure. And like to where we were talking about the teaching side, like, that's the other thing too. You know, if I say something, you know, about strategy or hunting or whatever it may be, people know it comes directly from experience. Cause if I'm, you know, it's not just style of production and content. It's also the things you hear other people say. Like if you haven't had experience with, you know, moon phases,
Right.
There's no reason for you to be talking about it and trying to educate on it,
Right.
because you heard someone else say something. So like, that's the other thing too. It's not just what you do, but it's also what you say. And like, if you're not being influenced by that stuff, then everything that you're saying to, teach is based on your experience.
Yeah.
And it could be limited experience, but at least it's based on experience and not what someone else said.
Yep. Yep. I try, like, when we have people like you on the podcast, like I try to let the guests talk to their experiences and then like maybe put that on a channel. But it's like, this is his opinion, because I've got like three more thoughts and we'll wrap this up because I know we're getting close on time.
Yeah,
but
you're good.
I've had this thought recently about like hunting, and there's so much argument. There's so many arguments over like how to do things and what's best. And like you mentioned, moon phase, is the new moon better? Is the full moon better? Or is like this temperature better, or this one, or pressure rising lower, whatever. There's so much of that because almost all of it is based off of anecdotal evidence, right? And personal experience.
Right.
There's not a ton of empirical data out there on deer, because even the stuff that is tracked and looked at and studied, like, it may not be deer in your area. A lot of that stuff's done like down south where there's huge deer populations and they can collar a bunch of them. So I think there's so much disagreement in it because there's no like set in stone information out there. And it just kind of is going off your own experiences.
Yeah. Yeah. And it may not be like, my experiences may not be the best for everyone. They probably aren't, but I think they're the best for me at least.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's always going to be, differences of opinion. That's a good thing ultimately. But I think making sure people are aware of that, knowing that, there's not one way to do everything. There's multiple ways, and you need to figure out what's best for you, and your situation, for the deer you're hunting on your property, like all that type of stuff. No one else is doing, your deer that you're hunting are the best possible teachers you have. It's not someone in Kansas, that you look up to, that's not your best teacher. Yes, you can take bits and pieces and apply them to your situation, but ultimately your deer are better teachers than anyone you look up to or watch.
Yeah, absolutely. Bottom line, you got to have conviction with what you're doing too. Like, if you think the new moon is better than the full moon and that works for you, awesome, because you're going to go hunt that new moon phase hard and be out there and maybe have success doing it. Whereas if you're like, I don't know which one's better, maybe I'll just stay home because this guy told me this way and the other guy told me that way. And like that doesn't do anybody any good. You gotta believe what you believe, be open-minded. But like when it comes to that kind of stuff that can go either way and there's maybe not necessarily a right or a wrong, as long as you're doing things kind of smart, you can do it your way and have success. And that's one of the great things about hunting. I had two more thoughts here. One of them is, I want to back up to your mobile hunting. Do you have like a preferred height you're trying to get to with your mobile setup, or is it just like you're getting to cover, or you higher or lower, or just cover?
I would say overall I'm lower than probably most guys. I don't see the need. I haven't, I think the only argument that sometimes guys will make outside of getting out of like, less chances of being spotted, like a lot of people want to get as high as possible to have chances of blowing your scent, further over the top of something. And I can see that makes sense in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
But if I have a ton of cover at 12 feet and I feel comfortable at 12 feet, I'm going 12 feet. I don't see any reason in getting higher, creating a more difficult shot angle. I love, from a footage standpoint, I love the more eye level or closer to eye level type of footage. Some of those hunts where I'm lower to the ground are some of the most exciting and like thrilling hunts there are, knowing that you're this close to the deer as opposed to being 25 feet up.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems like a less up close and personal when you're like that. So yeah, I just try to make sure I have good cover is the biggest thing. If I have good cover, I don't need to be very high.
Yeah, for sure. And the last thing we'll leave people with, if you could go back and either give yourself advice, or if you had advice for someone that was first starting out, what is one thing that you know now that you wish you would have known then that would have made you a better hunter and would have shortened that learning curve a little bit when it comes to hunting whitetails?
Hmm. I'm going to give you two answers here.
Okay.
One is going to be more strategy oriented, and the other one's going to be more just big picture.
Okay.
I'll start with the strategy one. I think, like, when I think of one thing that has been kind of an evolution of my hunting career, I mean, the mobile hunting one could be an example, but to be a little more specific, I think understanding thermals was a big one. You know, I think it's a natural progression for a lot of people. When we, you know, look back at our early days, we just went hunting, didn't even think about wind, let alone thermals. And then you start to think about wind direction, and then you get that fair, and then you start to think about, it's like kind of a step-by-step. So I think understanding, if you can understand thermals right away and how especially mature deer use them to their advantage, you know, how they work in the evenings versus the mornings. If you understand all of that, I think you're going to have a lot more effective setups. You're going to think about the spots a lot more than just wind direction, because we've all had those nights, or mornings, but nights especially where, you know, the wind dies down to nothing, and your wind direction essentially doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Then what are you playing off of? You're playing off those thermals. And so if you don't think about that or understand that, you know, I know there's a lot more talk today than there ever was about that, but I still think a lot of people maybe don't put a lot of thought into it. So that'd be one that comes to mind immediately, that, you know, if you're a newer hunter, if you can get that, you can get ahead of the game, become, you know, a lot more efficient and better hunter if you understand that right away. The other one is just more big picture, because I do spend a lot of time thinking about the next generation of hunters. I think are obviously vital to the sport, and, you know, I want them to, you know, have really good experiences and be as passionate about this as we are. There's a lot more vying for their time and attention, and so, you know, I think it's a challenge, right, to keep people interested. But I think the biggest thing is just you're setting your own expectations for success and enjoying the process more than the kill. I think that's the biggest thing that I wish I could, you know, pound it into the heads of young hunters. Like, they, especially in today's world, social media, you know, you scroll through and see, you know, trophy pictures, harvest pictures, like that's what gets all the attention. Right. And so, you know, people that may not have that success or may not have, you know, the situation that creates immediate success, you know, maybe their access to land is super limited. Doesn't mean they can't enjoy hunting, like, but it starts with understanding that it's about the hunt, the journey, you know, learning through failure, all those types of things. If you can somehow get that in your head to appreciate, you're going to be so much better off. If your idea of being a successful hunter is all about killing the largest antler deer you possibly can, so many of those young hunters are going to quit hunting so early. And so just trying to teach about the journey, highlight the importance of the stories of the hunts, all that type of stuff. Way easier said than done. I get that. We all want to kill big deer. But that's where I'm at in my career, is the journey's way, 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 way more rewarding than the kill. The kill is just a tiny little bonus at the end. Like, you know, I don't even strive for that really anymore. I strive to enjoy every single hunt along the way, every single encounter, every single failure. That's way more fun for me. And I've gotten there through a lot of, you know, years of experience. But if I could have that mindset at the beginning of my hunting career, I'd love it even more, you know? So I think not chasing the end goal, enjoying the process would be the biggest thing I'd try to communicate to a young hunter.
Spoken like a true baseball guy, process over results. I love it.
That's
it's
right.
Good stuff.
That's right.
There's a lot of parallels there. We could talk for another hour probably, but I'll let you get out of here.
I know
we're both trying to get to the stand this evening. So thanks again for coming on, taking some time out. I know you're a busy dude. I really appreciate you coming on and talking for a little bit about some hunting stuff, and hopefully we can do it again in the future.
Yeah, man, let's do it. I appreciate you inviting me back. Happy to join anytime, and best of luck to you and all the viewers.
Yep, you too.
Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Are you scouring the web for the best Black Friday and Cyber Monday deals? Stop it. Get Rakuten. Rakuten is a shopping sidekick that gets you cash back on gifts for everyone on your list. Right now, you can get up to 15% cash back at the stores you love. You can even stack cash back on top of the biggest sales of the year. That's savings on savings. It's more time shopping and less time searching. With Rakuten, you're always saving at your favorite stores on the things you're already buying. Cash back is automatically added to your account as you shop, and you can get paid with gift cards, PayPal, or check. Or eligible American Express card members can even choose to earn membership rewards points instead of cash back. It's truly a no-brainer. Now's the time to join. Up to 15% cash back ends on 12/2. Plus, new members will receive a welcome bonus after minimum qualifying purchases. Just go to Rakuten.com, download the app, or install the browser extension. That's Rakuten. Terms and conditions apply.